The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
2011, it was a peaceful revolution that started, with everybody, every Syrian from all of the backgrounds. Were on the grounds in their own towns and cities, calling for Assad to be toppled. I tell myself it's not over, even though I see that it's unfortunately things are became very dark now, much more complicated than 4 years ago. Who's to blame? Assad regime number one, and then the international community, and also the Syrian opposition. We have the foreign fighters coming from everywhere, whether they're joining ISIS or joining Nusra Front. Syria became a battle battlefield and a training land for jihadists. That's because of the Assad regime.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 11th, 2015. When Ola Abdulhamid al-Rifai was almost 19, she fled Damascus with her family of dissidents under death threats from the Bashar Assad regime. Since then, she has watched as Syria has imploded. While she was in college and getting started in Washington Middle East policy circles, millions of people have become refugees, great cities have become piles of rubble, and hundreds of thousands have died. Ola has stayed involved, organizing protests, working with refugees in Turkey, and advocating for a more involved U.S. and international posture with respect to Syria. I have known Ola since the day she left Syria. She and her family, some of the most courageous people I have ever met, stayed in my house for a few weeks when they first arrived in Washington. So it was an emotional interview for me when she came by the Brookings Institution last week to talk about the current situation in Syria and her own story. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 118, Ola Abdulhamid al-Rifai, One Syrian Story and a Country's Tragedy. Tell us a little about yourself, who you are and what you do in town and that sort of thing.
I am Ola, and I am a Syrian political asylee that I left Syria with my family in 2005. We came directly to Washington and have been here since. The reasons are because of the Assad regime and the death threats to my parents and their work at that time on civil society and human rights and minority rights back home in Damascus. And one thing led to another, and we crossed all of the red lines. And because of that, we were not feeling safe anymore in our homeland, our city, and we left.
So now you work at the Washington Institute.
Currently I am at the Washington Institute as an RA, a research assistant, working in the aeropotics program, mostly on Syria, sometimes on other projects related to the Middle East, of course, so North African countries. Before that, I was at different think tanks doing internships, and then before that, I was in school. I went to the University of Maryland, where I studied political science, Middle East studies, and history. Here I am now at the Institute, and I'm working on my homeland again. So
let's unpack this. When did you leave Syria? You left Syria before any of the current outbreak of war.
Yes, we left in 2005 in September, a few days before my birthday. It was the most depressing time for me and for my family in general. Basically, we predicted a revolution, and at a time when no one else saw that a revolution is going to happen in Syria.
How old were you?
When we left, I was 18, like right before my 19th birthday.
So explain a little bit about how your mother and stepfather got in trouble with the regime.
It's a family enterprise. So I grew up in a family that was always against the regime, and my mom lost her father in 1982 because of Assad killing machine. since that time, there was the Hama massacre, 1982, and my grandfather was one of the people who were criticizing both the Muslim Brotherhood and the Assad regime and criticizing violence, and he was an author and a historian and a public figure. He was arrested like as a political prisoner, was taken as a political prisoner, like lots of people, lots of students from their campuses too, who were against that. And the whole world did not know about Hama massacre until like a few days or a few weeks later. Then we move forward. That's my mom when she was young. She was, in her, you know, early, maybe 11 or 12 years old. It's like the problems are being passed down from a generation to another, from my mom's to, you know, and from my grandmother, my grandparents to my mom, and then to me, to my generation who went on the streets in 2011 and rose against this dictatorship regime. My parents work, so my biological dad passed away when I was young for health issues. My mom got remarried, and she got remarried to Ammar, who is a very passionate activist against the regime as well, publicly speaking, blogging about the corruption, all the problems in Syria, the child labor, the poverty, the doing research on the ground, and talking about it to from Damascus, going on international media all the time. He's one of the only person doing that way before the revolution started. So in early 2000s, 2001, they founded Therwa Foundation, their NGO in Damascus, and had a big network of activists working not just on Syria, but on the region. So they had people working on Egyptian politics or Egyptian affairs or Tunisian or Yemen and Syria and different countries, different activists in the region. Many of those activists actually were part of their home revolutions too, during when the Arab Spring started. Doing that work in Damascus under a dictatorship regime where we had the office and with employees and interns and people coming even from the U.S. to intern there and learn more things and be active and participate in some kind of civil society work. They touch a lot on the Kurdish issue in Therwa too, and the Kurds are discriminated against by the regime, and they really suffer. And they had their own revolution in 2004 that was being heavily cracked down on. So all that type of work, crossing, again, the red lines in terms of what the Assad regime, how the Assad regime saw it, led to receiving death threats by them. And that wasn't safe anymore. People were investigated with them at Therwa. My parents had to face that as well, and the Asif Shaukat, the head of the military intelligence guy, who is the brother-in-law of Bashar al-Assad, threatened my parents face-to-face to be killed in his office. I remember that day was the hardest day of my life, because I knew my parents were going to be interrogated with Asif, and me and my brother were home we had to be home and had to wait until they come back. I was very afraid. I thought that I might lose them. They went for like 5-6 hours, something like that. And I was just unable to speak anymore, just sitting there and hoping that I can see my parents again. Luckily, I did. They came back. And after all of these intense moments, we decided just to leave.
And why did the regime let you leave?
For my parents, well, my stepfather is the son of a very well-known, famous actress in the Arab world, a movie, television star. So her son doing that work, they were kind of, maybe, I mean, I'm trying to guess, maybe that, you know, being him is a very well-known family, so they kind of were careful not to hurt him and his family. But at the same time, because my parents were investigated with Asif Shaukat, the brother-in-law of Bashar, who also was kind of, we believe he was plotting for some kind of coup or something in within the government, and he wanted to take power. That's how we felt.
So it's not clear to you why you were allowed to leave.
It's not 100% clear, but we believe in the family that, because Asif Shaukat was trying to maybe have allies on his side and knew that Ammar and Khawla, my parents, are well-known people, and he wanted to challenge Bashar, and he knows that they have all the connections, my parents, with the Americans, with Europeans, and, you know, meaning that they're very well-known because of their work. So maybe he wanted to keep them on his side instead of, you know, against the will of Bashar himself, because Bashar al-Assad wanted my parents to be in jail. So kind of we believe that Asif was the one who basically helped, if I can say helped, but, you know, who removed the travel ban, because we were all banned from traveling, and we were able to leave because of him, not because of Bashar, because he, you know, because after that, actually, Assad was, like, surprised that we left, that my parents are out of the country. And even at the airport, there was this moment where we were not sure if we're leaving or not leaving, because we saw, like, a top general, like, kind of standing and staring at us. And I remember that I was questioning my parents, asking them, like, who is this guy? Why he's looking at us? What's going on? And I felt that we were kind of monitored. So we didn't know that we were monitored by the Assad, Bashar al-Assad people, or by Asif Shaukat people. Are we going to be arrested, or are we going to be leaving? Are we going to be able to fly out of Damascus? So it was like an Argo movie moment, I call it.
When did you know it was okay?
Once the doors were open and we saw the plane and that small shuttle, we got on the small shuttle and we're like, okay, I think we're leaving.
So you came to Washington. You've been here ever since. And since then, when you first came to Washington, I thought, well, these were the only Syrian refugees I would ever meet. And now there's how many million refugees from the Syrian conflict?
Oh, my God. Yeah. The official numbers are 4 million Syrian refugees in the region. And those are the registered ones. So the number is bigger. And then the IDPs are, also the official numbers are 7 million internally displaced. But I believe the number is bigger.
And what's the, this is out of a population of what?
A population of around that time, roughly around 23 million.
So of 23 million, you have something like 4 to 5 million external refugees.
Yes,
and
half of the population. And
7 or more million internally displaced. That's half the population.
Yeah.
Just talk about the problem of, you know, not all of them are living in Washington and working at the Washington Institute, right? So what's happened to the population of Syria in this conflict?
I am very lucky. I'm very fortunate. Like, I really extremely lucky to be safe, to be here, to be with my family. But everybody else is suffering very badly. I saw it in my own eyes when I went to Turkey, to southern Turkey, in areas very close to the Syrian border. I know from my, I still have family back home in Damascus and in Homs and other areas, you know, from them how their lives are, you know, are not easy anymore. We know from friends and neighbors and other people how they lost their loved ones, or how their cities were bombed and shelled and demolished, how their kids are don't go to school, how all these problems, in addition to the torture photos that are being released, the leaked ones from Caesar, for example, are just a very small portion of the reality on the ground. When I saw Caesar photos, I was on the floor at the hill when he was testifying, and I looked at them and I imagined my grandfather, 1982. Maybe that's the same way he was killed, because they were saying that he was killed after long hours of torture. So this was happening at that time, and now it's happening all over again on a bigger scale. The whole country is suffering. There is pain in every family, in every house.
And the refugee population, there's a big refugee population in Turkey, which you've spent time with. Mm-hmm. And there's also a large one in Jordan, right?
There's a large one in Jordan, there's a large one in Lebanon. The largest is in Lebanon, I believe. All over the region, people are also migrating to Europe and to the U.S. Some of them, it's not always easy, but they're trying to find a better life somewhere outside of that region and outside of the war. Lots of people are trapped in camps, so they can't go anywhere, you know, the refugee camps. The 4 million refugees are, for the most part, are in the camps, or, you know, in Turkey or Jordan or Lebanon.
And how are conditions in those camps?
I went to Turkey, and I didn't go to Jordan or Lebanon. I haven't had the chance, to be honest. I actually don't have as a political asylee, also, I don't have the papers to go.
So what country's passport do you travel under?
The American government has given me and my family American travel documents, which are similar to a U.S. passport, but because we're not citizens yet, so we use them in addition to our green cards, and we can travel with both. I can't use the Syrian passport. I don't even want to use it. And it's been expired for years. And once we applied for asylum, you know, we can't use it. And I don't want it. I'm not proud of it. So.
Are you not proud of Syria, or are you not proud of the government?
Of course I'm not proud of the government. I mean, I'm ashamed by that regime. But I love my people. I love my country so much. I've always wanted to go back. I dreamed of a day when everyone is going to rise against the regime. I always wanted to be participating in the protests on the ground. It's impossible to be there. But we were doing that here in D.C. So once people were protesting there, we went here to the White House. I organized lots of protests by the White House, the Syrian embassy, did lots of activities to help out, whether humanitarian projects or, you know, awareness. I saw in my own eyes how children, let's say the children in southern Turkey with their families who ran away from cities or areas like Aleppo or the suburbs of Aleppo, because Gaziantep, where I went, is very close to Aleppo, like around an hour and a half away. People have lost everything. They lost family members, they lost their homes, they lost their businesses, they lost their schools that shouldn't have no school, they lost all of their lives, like everything, they lost everything. I felt the same way with my family when we left Syria back in 2005, that we also lost everything, because my mom, but luckily I didn't lose a family member, so I can't imagine what people are going through. It's extremely difficult. But my mother wanted to pack stuff from home in Damascus. And she told me, and I was unhappy with that. I was like, why we have to take our stuff from here and pack it and take it with us to whatever, the U.S. I don't want to travel. I didn't want to leave. I was very unhappy. I was crying. I didn't want to go. And she said, I'm going to try to make you feel home in a different place. Trust me, let's take those items with us, because they're going to make you feel home in a different land.
So, and do you feel at home here?
I do, but I don't. It's very hard to answer that question. I do, but I don't. This nation is my second home, and I love the U.S. so much. It shaped me, made me be who I am today, helped me, supported me in many ways, learned so much from this country, and I'm still learning, and I want to be here. But at the same time, I'm from there, from Syria, the land that's never had the opportunity to... never had the opportunity to be who we want to be there. And everybody's struggling. Everyone lived under fear for 42 plus years.
So when a lot of Americans look at the Syrian conflict, they see... They see on the one hand the Assad regime, and nobody... Well, some people have illusions about the Assad regime, but nobody should have any illusions about the Assad regime. And on the other hand, they see al-Nusra, ISIS, and they say, what useful role can we play here, caught between these two incredibly undesirable forces? When you look at the conflict, you describe a people's uprising against the regime. How do you look at the conflict now? That's what it was in 2011, but what is it now?
Yeah, 2011, it was a peaceful revolution that started, with everybody. Like, everybody from every Syrian from all of the backgrounds were on the grounds in their own towns and cities calling for Assad to be toppled. It's a dignity revolution. And that's what we call Thawrat al-Karame. And one of the first chants was, Syrian people will not be humiliated. Shab Suri ma binzal. And that's still there. And there's still protests until this day on a smaller scale because of the violence, and the crackdown of the Assad regime and the militia, the Iranian militias, and then ISIS and Nusra and all of these groups. And I'm going to get to that. But the revolution did not really, I don't want to say it's over. I mean, I tell myself it's not over, even though I see that it's, unfortunately, things are became very dark now, much more complicated than 4 years ago. And who's to blame? Assad regime, number one. And then the international community, and also the Syrian people, the Syrian opposition, not the people on the ground. People on the ground have been suffering for so long, and they need help. And that's the problem, that nobody listened to the voices on the ground, not the opposition, not the international community. And that's why it's complicated today. We have ISIS in the country controlling... maybe 30 to 35 of Syria's land. That's because of the Assad regime. We have the foreign fighters coming from everywhere, whether they're joining ISIS or joining Nusra Front. Syria became a battle training, battlefield and a training land for jihadists. That's because of the Assad regime. We should not forget about, during the Iraq war and how Assad was sending all these radicals to Iraq war, and then they come back, he arrested them, and then he released them in 2011. Most of the leaders were released in 2011 for him to prove a point that he's fighting terrorists in Syria. Well, yes, we do have terrorists, but that was part of his strategy for him to stay in power. And ISIS did not come from, you know, from the moon. ISIS and Nusra Front and the jihadists were doors were open to them to be there. And Assad uses their existence as an excuse for him to stay in power, as I just said. So today there's a lot of things that can be done to change that. It's not too late, even though the country is, for the most part, demolished because of the fighting. But without international help, we can't move forward. The Syrian people were neglected. Their voices were not being heard for the past 4 years. This country, the U.S., can do so much to help out.
What are the things that the United States should be doing that it isn't doing?
Yeah. All right. So from the beginning, since 2011, Syrians on the ground were asking for a no-fly zone, for example. A no-fly zone to protect the people, a safe haven for the people from Assad bearer bombs. Everybody ignored that. So a no-fly zone, if it's implemented, it can, you know, help out people to be, you know, to find a refuge, and also for a potential transitional government to function on the ground, not just to be the same opposition is outside, whether in Istanbul or in D.C. or in Europe, and they have to be on the ground. How can we move forward and, you know, talk about transition if people are not there in Syria? And we need to stop Assad from, you know, dropping barrel bombs and gassing people to death with chemical weapons and chlorine gas and torturing people, to death in prisons. So a no-fly zone would be a key. Then hitting ISIS, really hitting ISIS. ISIS is not being hit in Syria. I believe ISIS is being teased, not hit. Kind of like, it's just, it's... Honestly, it's a joke, those airstrikes in Syria. They're not effective. So the focus now is on Iraq, and the long-term project is Syria, and that's totally wrong. I disagree with that.
You think they should be simultaneous projects, or you think the short-term project should be Syria and the longer-term project is Iraq?
No, they should look at both countries, because ISIS is here and there. ISIS is in Iraq and ISIS is in Syria, and if you hit them you have to contain them in both areas, not just in one area and let them be free in another, first of all. And then, as I said, the no-fly zone is a key. And then to pressure Assad to negotiate a transition, we need to show him some force. Geneva II was also a joke. Iranian involvement. Iranian officials have been bragging about taking lots of territories in the country. Who's going to stop the Iranians? Who's going to stop Hezbollah? We need international, help. Who's going to stop the Nusra Front people and the Al-Qaeda agendas in the country? We also need international help. It's like, I'm not asking for boots on the ground, but I'm asking for a no-fly zone, a serious political discussions about Syria's future, pressuring Iran and pressuring Assad, helping out the whatever left from the moderate rebels on the ground, because they do still exist, no matter what people say about that. They are still there, but they need help. They're waiting for... they were outnumbered by the jihadis, by the Nusra and other Salafi groups who have all the weapons and the money. So those need to support, and then we can move forward and start rebuild that nation if we can. It's going to take a long time. Estimates say that we need 40 years to rebuild what was destroyed in Syria, and get it back to where it was during 2011.
And what role do you see yourself playing in rebuilding the country when the war is over?
Lots of things. I'm waiting for the opportunity to be able to go back and be on the ground and help help with everything I can help with, whether it's civil society building, whether, you know, any project, basically. I see myself working with the children. I feel the children need a lot of help. They are a last generation, and they are trapped in camps. We need to build schools. We need to teach. I just want to give back to the country, or, I mean, give, you know, try to help out my people. Whether, you know, I don't really mind doing anything that's going to move Syria forward, but I see that we have to invest in the children, Syria's children, because they are the next generation, and they are the ones who are going to... Who we're responsible of now, and they're gonna ask us one day, why did you leave us alone? Why didn't you help us? So we should. I encourage people to, you know, help them out. And then there's lots of stuff that needs to be done inside of the country, in Syria, on all levels: economic, social, political. We have a long way to go.
Thanks very much for joining us, Ola.
Of course. Thank you so much.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. About 1,000 folks a week are downloading the podcast, and we think we can do better. We want the Lawfare Podcast to reach more people, so please, if you liked this episode, tweet it. Share it on Facebook, Reddit, Dig, or whatever other social media you use. And take the time to rate us and review us on iTunes or whatever other podcast distribution system you employ. Our music, as always, is performed by the redoubtable Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.